The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now it's True Wealth, presented by Little John Financial Services. Here is David Littlejohn with True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang. It's that time of the week, your favorite Tuesday you've had all week, and it is time for the True Wealth Radio Show. I'm your host, Dave Littlejohn, and I am stoked to have you joining me in studio today.
I'm back again. It's Matt Dixon.
You still here? Love it. Love it. Gang, today we're going to break down some things that I think are super relevant in the financial world, but we don't necessarily think of it this way, and that's why it's important to have the discussion, because I want you to think this through a little bit, and that is, when do expectations not match reality, right? There's a kind of an expression in our office, right? It says that the customer isn't always right, but they need to always be happy. And how do you do that? Well, for one, you manage the expectation. You know, I have a funny story about calling in to get help on a brand X store, not local, by the way, but I was calling out of area for help. I won't say who it is, but it rhymes with Home Bleepo. And they, you know, the person that I was speaking with was just really committed to not having me become a customer.
Really?
All the reasons that I shouldn't do this. And it just left me with this real cognitive dissonance. Like, I just called to become a customer and was told all the reasons I shouldn't be a customer.
That's an interesting take on customer service.
It worked. I mean, if it was like, go away, customer, I nailed it.
Yeah? What were you calling about, was it?
I need, have a property out of area and needed to get blinds measured and installed.
Ah.
And I was just calling around because there's a lot of back order. And
okay.
So it was, they oftentimes have things in stock. So
sure.
It's just, hey, you know, can something like this happen? And, well, you know, this was silly.
Huh.
It was a failed expectation, right? Expectations not managed well means that people struggle with it. And I think that that is got a lot of parallel to real life right now.
Okay, give me an example.
How many people have asked if this market's going to crash?
Oh my gosh, I hear it all the time.
I know,
everyone's
right?
Saying it. It's going to crash. It's going to crash.
Right. And here's the thing. Why?
Because I think it comes down to they just don't like the administration. And
well, I think around here, that's really common.
I mean, yeah, for
right?
sure.
Although it seems to me that this administration's coming under fire from lots of angles, including folks that have historically been pretty in their camp. And it's say, look, guys, you're making it harder here. Maybe we should. Never mind.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, there's some of that. But I heard everything from just we're due. To, well,
yep.
Clearly there's runaway inflation, therefore the market
that's
has to collapse.
That's the second one that I've heard probably the most is the right? inflationary
and
piece.
And I again, I ask, why? Right? Why must it crash?
Right.
Okay. And this is an important question because we oftentimes get to where our emotions are wagging the dog instead of our brain.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably not fair because our brain actually, you know, makes the emotions too. But let's just say that our emotions, like our heart is overriding our brain. That's better for the illustration, right? I mean, we feel this way, but can you think it through to a logical conclusion where that happens?
Well, a lot of people only think two ways, the market's going up or the market's going down.
I think there's some of that, yes.
And we kind of forget, what if it's not really going up or down? What if it's kind of moving to the side?
That, yes, right? What if?
Yeah.
Right? But what if the market, I mean, my suspicion is at some point the markets are going to fall. But what makes the market fall? Don't overcomplicate
that,
this, right?
That's a lot. I mean, yeah.
Well,
it could be a lot of different things.
At the most simple, right? You have a material change in supply or demand.
Yeah.
And since rarely is it, the supply of stocks all disappeared, it means that the demand to purchase them changed.
Market sentiment.
Well, it could be market sentiment. It could be forced. Like in 2008, when everything started to really collapse, it was because the banking system started to collapse and then loans started getting called. And so all of the liquidity, the available cash that was otherwise going into the markets wasn't available anymore. So that effectively changes the amount of demand, right? I have fewer dollars available. I got to put my dollars elsewhere, so it won't be in stocks.
Mm-hmm.
So that demand dries up. The bid side of the stock market, that's, remember, bid is the people wanting to get it. Ask is the people saying, yeah, I'll, you know, I'm asking this much for my stock. Okay, well, I'm willing to bid this much to buy it. Nobody bids, and you want to sell, price falls, right?
Do you
think
that the computerized trading has also kind of changed the way that the markets move?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's been changing it for, you know, the better part of 20 years or more.
Right.
Probably more than that, honestly. I mean, the computerized trading has changed and continues to change the marketplace. But the fundamental driver is still supply or demand, whether the demand is from a computer or the demand is from a person.
Right.
So if nobody wants to buy the stock, the price, this works in the housing market, right? If you want to buy a house right now, you know what you have to do?
Bid up the asking price.
Yeah, fast. You have to hurry.
Get out there. Offer more money than they're asking for it.
It's crazy, but the demand is so high. And part of the reason the demand is so high is because mortgage rates are
super low.
Super low. Historically low. And if you have super low rates,
you can afford more house.
Well, and remember, we have done other things. Like, we've made it hard to build houses. Right?
Yeah.
Oregon has a lot of land use laws and has a lot of permitting involved and a lot of costs associated with building. And then on top of that, because of supply disruption, there's less supply of certain things. So it's more expensive to compete to buy the things it takes to build the house.
It's true.
All of those things add to the price. So you have supply restrictions, massive demand, and cheap money so people can bid the price up. And you know what we call that? Inflationary.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that's literally what it is. It's this, okay, well, there's that the assets are increasing in price rapidly because of the conditions in the marketplace. So what conditions need to change in order to get the stock market to crash? What's going to take demand out of the market? And there are things out there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there are plenty of things. One is inflation could mean, hey, things got so expensive, I don't have disposable income to go into the stock market. I have to use all of my income just to support life.
That's a good point.
Right? That could really happen.
Yeah.
That tends to hit the fringe of the market first, less of the institutional money. But, you know, something else is interest rates could go up. Now, why would interest rates go up? There's a natural process, right? Let's think about this, Matt.
Yeah.
If you're a lender of money and inflation is happening mm-hmm. around you, what do you want to do as a lender?
You've got to make a higher return, so you're going to have to up your rates.
You're going to have to up your rates. Why?
Because people keep borrowing at such a low rate, you have to have a return at some point.
Well, it's protection, right? I mean, if you don't know what rates are going to be in the future, but it looks like they'll be higher, you need to price protection in for you.
Yeah.
You can't loan money out and then turn around and be like, well, I'm trapped in this terrible loan now.
Yeah, because not everyone's going to pay. People are going to default.
And not just that. Let's say that I have fantastic credit and I ask if I can borrow. We're going to pick a number. I want to borrow $100,000 from you.
Mm-hmm.
So first, woohoo, you can loan me $100,000. But second is, if I ask for you to loan me that money for a period of 10 years, what is it going to take for you to part with $100,000 and accept interest payments for 10 years from me?
It's going to have to outpace inflation naturally.
Well, it's going to have to outpace inflation, and it should have to outpace other opportunities that you could use that money
right.
for. So it needs to be a good, like an attractive investment for you. That means you have to mm-hmm. assess not only my risk as a borrower, can I pay you back, but also, what's your opportunity cost?
Yeah.
Over 10 years. And it's probably relatively high. So I would not think that you were going to, you know, you want to give me a loan for 2%?
Probably not. I mean, if inflation's at 2%.
No, I don't want to do that.
Ugh.
Yeah. I mean, especially if inflation's going to run at 6 or 7%.
Which doesn't seem too unfeasible.
Right. And so the market hasn't figured out if it's really going to do that or not. Right? It
doesn't kind of like a game of checkers, isn't it? Or chess.
There are some elements to that, right?
I mean, yeah.
And one slider moves, and the question is, does this continue or not, right? Is it persistent inflation, or is this something that was a hiccup in the system because of COVID.
It'll be, I think only time can tell.
Oh, yeah. I mean, ultimately, we will know with the rearview mirror of history.
For sure.
But if we were to take some speculative, you know, look at this, you know, I would argue that we are seeing inflation and it's becoming permanent.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, wages are going up.
I mean, are the price of cars really going to go down anytime soon?
Well, if you can't build enough cars and people want them, then price goes even higher.
Exactly.
So if we have an inflationary environment, that could be a headwind for the markets.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But on the flip side of it, what happens if an inflationary market, companies are able to make more money?
I was going
to
say, markets typically beat inflation. So
they typically do.
They adjust. They're not.
Yeah. So they can usually, you can see some volatility, but historically, markets have been the stock market in particular has been a very good mechanism for outpacing inflation. Bond markets, less of a guarantee, right? But bond markets are not stock markets.
Okay? It's true.
Fixed income is different. Different considerations. So to me, when we look at this market and we think about expectations versus reality, we want to understand some of the things that are played. Now, there's a bunch more stuff going on in this market that I think is relevant to decide, should it crash or not, right?
Yeah.
For example, we've got apparently some stuff going on in Washington, D.C. You heard about this?
I think, aren't we getting close to a profit break?
We can take an obscene profit
break. Yeah, I think this is a good spot to leave our listeners kind of on that edge. What is happening in D.C.?
So we're going to talk about expectations versus reality, and we'll talk about how Washington, D.C. has met no one's expectations. But we got to take this break first. Stick around, we'll be right back. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. So, if you were just joining us, oh man, the fun you have missed. Matt and I have been chatting up, and it is all available on podcast. Do you know how to find it yet?
Yeah, go to the Little John FS website.
Okay, and there's
do it.
Yeah, just do it.
Do it.
So at the Little John FS website, go under the What We're About tab, and you're going to find three columns or three tags, right?
Educate, plan, invest.
Right, and it's under the Educate tab.
Okay.
And this is one of those my personal hang up. And this has to do with my take on the industry, right? I am not crazy about sales in financial services. I realize that there's nothing like wrong with sales, right? It's perfectly noble when done properly and ethically. But my training came out of sales only instead of becoming a practitioner. So I sort of shunned a lot of that. And my response to it is education. If you can teach people how to understand this stuff, they can sort of naturally arrive at what is in their best interest if you can educate them on the pros and the cons, right? And then it's less of a sale than just a, oh, well, clearly this is the next step,
yeah.
Right? So that's always been sort of my take on this one. Now, this all plays back into today's theme, right?
Okay.
Expectations versus reality, okay? At the break, we're talking about the markets, and specifically people keep asking, is this thing going to crash? Now, Matt, is this market going to crash?
Eventually, but when is the question?
Yeah, or I don't know.
It always does.
Right? I
mean, it always dips.
Historically, it has. Right?
Yeah.
Historically, it has, and historically, it's recovered, too. So we could say it's always done that until someday if it doesn't.
But right.
I continue to tell people, I think we got a much bigger problem. If the market's collapse.
And by collapse, you mean like collapse and don't return.
Well, that's the next step. Like if the markets collapse and they're like gone, what good is your money anyway? Like what does your stock matter or your bonds matter if the entire financial system fails?
You got bigger problems.
Yeah, it's really, that's not the main concern. I think the concern that some people have, and I'm seeing folks that are they're getting pretty worked up, right? We're in an interesting time in history where the emotions are running hot.
It's the hottest I've ever seen it.
It's the hottest I've ever seen it. And not hot like everybody is being mean directly to each other's face, although that probably is happening. But
people are wigging out. They're making crazy decisions, rash decisions.
People talking about, I'm moving, or I'm going to expatriate, or you know things like that. And I think, how have we arrived at a point where our emotions are so agitated that people can't see the data?
I think it's just a collection of a lot of things.
Well, I do too. I think that just have added stressor after stressor, and unfortunately,
people are starting to snap under the pressure.
It's the cycle. Even if you're listening to this program right now, if you find yourself listening and either trying to say, yeah, that's what I said all along, or no way, man.
Don't do that.
careful. Because if your emotions are singing that song, it's like, let's hang on here. We're really going to try to work with data. Our opinions are in this thing. That's happening, right?
But you can't avoid that.
Yeah, there's always some editorial.
We always have a personal bias.
Yeah, that's happening. But the trick is, can we sort of minimize it or contextualize it so that you can make
that's a good way to say
call,
it.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to try to do is keep everything in context.
Or look at the numbers.
So let's talk about something now. If everybody's, not everybody, there's a bunch of you out there, and I admire you, and keep beating this drum, by the way, which is the markets are going to go up, the markets are going to go down, right? And I generally don't watch it that closely because, one, I can't control it, and two, because of what we've just sort of described is the long-term outcome will likely be positive. If it is not, it likely doesn't matter, right? Because it means the financial system's got much bigger problems. If the largest companies on the planet all fail simultaneously, right? Like, no bueno. So
it's true.
I'm less concerned about that. But people watch, so let's discuss what is going on with this market. Now,
at the break, you said something about Washington, D.C.
We cannot avoid it, okay?
So,
because you know what Washington, D.C. represents? And when I describe this, this is not a grab your pitchforks and torches kind of moment, okay? But it represents a systemic destabilizer or a systemic threat, if you will. Threat's a more hostile word, okay? But systemic destabilizer is that it creates systemic risk for everything, right?
If
Washington changes the way taxes happen,
it
affects everything.
And it can sure send a lot of things into a tailspin
quick. And if it's not really Washington, but at the same time it's sort of connected to Washington, if the Federal Reserve that's integrated with our monetary system, if they change policy, that is going to have systemic effects.
Do you want to talk about what the Federal Reserve really is for our listeners?
It's a network of banks. Okay, the Federal Reserve is a network of banks that's not owned by the government.
See, and I think that's what the listeners need to hear.
That's the part that's really interesting is the Federal Reserve banking system is a private banking system, not governmental. That's the wacky part about it.
And I feel like a lot of people miss that point, that the banks are really controlling a lot of what's going on.
The banks have massive, massive control. Now, the government can legislate behavior of banks and does. Okay, they put parameters around banks, and this all kind of goes back to Great Depression era stuff and having to stabilize the banking system.
But give us an example, like if the Federal Reserve Board or the federal banking system, if they want to change something radically, what could they do? Give the listeners an example of what they could do.
So first of all, the Reserve Board, there's several different governors of the banks in the system, right? There's like 9 or 12 banks or something like that.
I think it's 12.
Around the country.
Yeah.
I think there's 12 banks and they all have governors, but I think only 9 governors are in the Federal Open Market Committee. This is stuff that, you know, this is what Investopedia is for, right? You can actually look up the exact figures on this one. And I don't go in and study the composition of the board at the Federal Reserve.
Okay? Who would?
Like, how many hours in a day do we have
when
you're trying to help people with personal finance. But the way this thing works, so that you elect the board of governors, they all get together, and one of the things that they could do, here's your example, Matt.
Yep.
They could change the reserve requirements of the banking system.
Exactly.
So the reserve requirement is how much money a bank must retain on its balance sheet relative to the amount of money it's loaning out to people.
Okay.
Because they don't, if you give a bank a dollar, they don't loan that dollar out. They loan part of that dollar out. Okay. Mm-hmm. The part that they don't loan out is the reserve. And that's because the idea is if 10 people are bank customers, not all 10 of them are going to come back and ask for their money at the same time. So they look at the statistically say, well, maybe 1 in 10 people is going to need their money at any given time. So we better have more than 1/10 in reserve.
Sure.
So that we can cover those calls on the assets. Somebody shows up and says, give me some money. I had to take it out of my account. Then you have it around. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's the reserve requirement. If they change the reserve requirement, that ripples through the entire system. Every bank has to adjust their lending ratios, which changes the number of loans that can be made in the system, which changes the supply and demand curve.
Boom.
Significantly.
There it is.
Okay. So it totally matters.
Yeah.
How does it all tie into Washington, D.C. right now? What is the elephant in the room that's being talked about in Washington, D.C., and it's just getting kicked around right now?
Well, we have the big infrastructure deal that's on.
So what,
on the docket.
What do you know about the infrastructure deal generically? Like, I won't quiz you on the specifics, and this is not a make. This is not
a catch
Matt
on his heels. Do you want a dollar amount? Because I think it was around $3
trillion. $3.5 trillion.
$3.5 trillion. Okay. They want to invest it in infrastructure, rebuilding roads, all of this stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But it's way more than that, as a lot of our astute listeners know, right? There's something called what they're calling human infrastructure.
Okay.
Yeah,
do you want to elaborate on what that
social
entails?
Programs,
mm-hmm.
right? Things that aren't infrastructure at all, but if you call them human infrastructure, then you can rationalize it being there.
Right.
We have another term for it politically, pork, right?
Pork,
yeah. Like, so let's just include extra.
Is this an acronym or is
no,
this
no,
like?
No, it's a real thing.
Okay.
I mean, lots of the time, historically, bills have things inserted into them because it's like favors that politicians give to each other to get them to vote for something. So maybe Oregon needs bridge funding.
Mm-hmm.
And so our representatives are out there. If it's in the House, then, you know, for like Roseburg, I think it's DeFazio is still the representative, right? So maybe what he does is he gets federal dollars appropriated in a bill to come back and be used on bridge projects. But it's attached to a bill that has nothing to do with building bridges.
So it's scratching each other's backs in a sense.
Yeah, but that process is called adding pork to the bill, right? So
okay.
It's just this fat that gets mixed in to the bill just to get people to agree to vote for it. And how else do you get 10,000 page bills? Like, do you really think that our representatives read these things?
Right.
It's like, hey, go read this half a volume of encyclopedias written in legalese, because I'm sure you're going to understand all of it, and then vote yes or no on all of it.
Right.
Right? It's ridiculous is what it is. And everybody from every side of the aisle knows. It's just that people turn the other way if they're getting what they want.
For sure.
Okay? So what does this whole shenanigan mean? From D.C., if you got a $3.5 trillion plan on the proposal from the Democrat side of the aisle, okay? Now, I'm not trying to be partisan. This is just saying this is the side of the aisle. Now, the Republicans are also, not to be outdone, have a counterproposal, and when both parties are trying to agree, they call it bipartisan, like everybody's agreeing. So that it's a partisan look at the $3.5 trillion, and then there's another counter proposal that's like $1.2 trillion.
What blows my mind is how much money that really is.
Right. So they've got these two different proposals, and then there's a hostage agreement in between, right?
Okay.
The hostage agreement is the federal debt limit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what that is how much money the United States is effectively allowed to borrow to pay its bills.
Right.
And so since we borrow more than we bring in tax revenue,
keep digging that hole deeper.
They keep raising the debt ceiling. And every year or two, this seems to come up where we're going to run out of money unless we raise the debt ceiling.
And they just always end up raising it.
They do. So here's been the political quagmire as I understand it.
Okay.
I don't know all of this, by the way. I'm not a poli-sci expert. Okay, this gets deep in the weeds here. But basically, the Democrats have enough votes to...
They could do it on their own.
They could raise the debt ceiling and move on.
But they don't want to do that.
Well, it changes the dynamic of then passing their infrastructure spending bill. So they could then have the votes to pass this $3.5 trillion bill, and they do it with zero Republican votes.
Oh, wow.
But that's a sort of a dangerous political statement when you have 100% partisanship. If anything goes wrong, it's really easy to blame you.
For sure.
Right? So they don't really want to do that. So there was a recent extension of the deadline. It was like October 8th was the original deadline. Now it's been kicked out to like December 2nd.
Buying themselves some time to try and strategize.
Well, and my guess is they already made a trade on the votes. So it's not going to be $3.5 trillion. It's going to be something different. We don't know necessarily what it will be, but they probably already made the trade in order to get the vote to extend it, to buy some time to package up the trade.
Oh.
Okay. So what does all this mean now? It means we take another obscene profit break.
You're killing me here, David.
When we come back, I'm going to tell you
what
it means.
We're getting to the juicy part here.
I know.
You're leaving everyone on a cliffhanger.
Well, hang out. We'll be right back, and I'll tell you. But we got to take this break first. Stick around. It's Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Show. So, Matt, how are they going to get caught up?
Well, they need to probably go back and re-listen to this. So they need to go to the website. Yeah, they need to check out the podcast.
Yep, littlejohnfs.com. All kinds of fun stuff in there, by the way, for... probably at least half of you listening, although statistically
100% of our listeners could benefit from this.
Okay, I'll go with that.
If they're 8 years old, they can learn how much their piggy bank can save if they just buck up and start putting the money in there, right?
It's fun. So statistically, and this is really something, but statistically, about 45% of people report having no investments of any kind. About 55% say they have some form of retirement plan or stock ownership.
I can vouch for that. I saw it today. He's not lying, folks. This is true stuff.
That means like 45 out of 100 people need to listen to this show more, right? Like that's
statistics 101 right there.
it's the basics. Now, at the break, what we were trying to explain. Now, today's one of these shows we're talking about managed expectations, when your expectations and reality don't match. Okay. And
that's every day, though, right?
Well, it really is every day.
Like, honey, I want a 5-course meal and I'm coming home to Costco chicken and mac and cheese. Come on.
That sounds delicious.
It does, actually. Especially their pumpkin pie. I don't know if you know this, David, but I'm a sucker for Costco's $5 pumpkin pies. Like, I'll eat one in 2 days by myself. It's disgusting.
You can get away with that now.
I know.
I could try that. I mean, like, I could eat that, but then I would wear it. So, I am trying to learn better health habits because
I run it off, David. Run it off.
I'm capable of eating terrible. Yes. So, but we are way off the beaten path now.
Okay.
The idea here is expectation and reality oftentimes don't match up for people. This year has been a real conundrum, hasn't it? I mean, the markets have been way up. I mean, I think the S&P is still up close to 15, 16% year to date.
It's really crushing it, and the volatility has been really low.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just the last couple weeks it spiked some, but it's coming back down remarkably enough.
Yeah.
Now, volatility is an interesting measure, of course, but we can get some indication of volatility by how the options market is pricing things. And so we will measure that. We use an index called the Volatility Index, or the VIX, and it's been declining again, right? Mm-hmm. So volatility's coming out of the marketplace. Some of it is, I think, because of Washington, D.C. kicking the can down the road, or looking like they kicked the can down the road, right?
Yeah.
Because at the break, we talked about the big package, right? That I shouldn't phrase that way at all. We talked about the big spending package.
Okay.
The Democrat Party has proposed a $3.5 trillion infrastructure spend. It's a stimulus spending program, so economic stimulus program. And the Republicans have been fighting this, right? And now they've set up sort of a partisan standoff between Democrats and Republicans, and they're using another element, the debt limit, as part of the bargaining chip. And it appears, I literally got this during the break, a notice that the House, so it passed the Senate, the House has now raised the debt ceiling, and I believe it's been pushed out until sometime in early December, where this debate will have to happen again.
So they really are kicking that can down the road.
They're absolutely kicking it down the road, and they always, and when I say always, this has been historically what has occurred.
We've
never
problems.
Not raised the debt ceiling. Right? We've never not raised it.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure why we play this game, other than it is a tool of political leverage and appearances.
It's a chess game.
Right. It's optics. Okay. And this is part of the problem. And I hope that I don't have high hopes that this can happen, but wouldn't it be really wild if folks could kind of get over the tribalism and stop assuming that the team that you have chosen is always right and the team that you oppose is always wrong?
Yeah. I mean, I feel
what
like
a wacky idea that there's some compromise and that maybe somebody is fronting a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. They're putting a little bit out there saying, oh, look, I'm giving you this image, but it's false. It's not really the truth of what's going on.
Yeah.
Could that ever happen in politics?
It's like 80% of the time I feel like they're...
I think that you listen to the way people speak, and there's no commitments in their language any longer because nobody wants to be caught in the lie. So you get all these pants on fire rules where it's like, well, I never said that. I kind of said something
non-definitive,
you know,
statements.
Non-committal, and you've assumed these things, but I didn't say it, right? They do that all the time. Lots of inference, but not necessarily a hard-coded, it is this.
Yeah.
And then if you do make it is this comment, it can come back forever, right?
Yeah.
Oh, back in 1971, before you were even capable of discerning anything, it's like, you're 8 years old and you said this? Like, I was 8, right?
We see that all the time. And it's part of
the
new cancel culture. Like,
it's a weaponization. Keep in mind, you know, and I'll say it on air, cancel culture is a way to silence the opposition.
Yep.
Okay? That is what it is. So when it happens, it's the effect of saying, you have free speech on paper, but we will weaponize the system against you so that you don't execute it.
That's a good way of saying it, David. I like
right?
that.
We will yeah. scare you into silence, because who wants to be canceled? There are a bunch of you out there listening right now. And I'm not that you wear a mask because it's easier than rocking the boat.
Mm-hmm.
You don't believe in it. You wear
oh, yeah.
it because you don't want to rock the boat.
Yep.
Okay. And I am not judging you for that, by the way. Okay? I'm not. But I don't understand the logical connection. I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus either, because I've been public on this program saying I got vaccinated. Okay?
Yeah.
So, I mean, everybody has their different take on this one. I believe in your right to choose your own health decisions. Right? That's where I live on this thing.
Yeah.
So I'm
that's
okay
a good
saying
place
that.
To be.
But I got it. So when I say these things, I'm like, I think it's weird, though, that why was I originally told, well, get it so you don't have to wear the mask? And then it was like, psych! Like, okay, you're driving me nuts. Because that was the whole reason. Otherwise, what was the incentive again? So it's, but the messaging is challenging now, right? Really what it is can we please make good social health decisions? But I would be way happier with it being voluntary.
Yeah.
And for the folks that don't want the vaccine at this point. That's different than folks that can't get it. That's a real small group, and I know that's a hard one. But for the folks that don't want it, I would say choose your own adventure. But get the consequences too. There's no such thing as a consequence-free decision. And
we pretend that there is.
Yeah, we socially
try all the time.
We try to make it that, like, oh, we need people to behave this way. And so I go, okay, well, then are you going to apply the consequences if they don't? Well, no. Then it's useless, right? It's useless. So if you don't want to wear a helmet, I think you're an idiot, but I'm okay with it, right? Because it turns out you're probably cheaper. Because you don't make it. It's gross, right? I'm not advocating for that, but I'm saying those are the natural consequences to these kinds of things. And so where do we draw the line on consequences? Like, you can't only apply the laws to people that have something to lose.
Mm-hmm.
All right, soapbox over. Back to this expectations of market. Here's why I think this is all this whole conversation gets back to relevance. It is a messaging issue. And if that whole diatribe there got your blood boiling, good. You know why? Because now I can ask you, are you thinking with your heart or your brain?
Oh, wow. I like how you spun that one around.
Okay. Is it your heart or your brain? Because if you're mad at me for saying that, why? Which part did I corner you on?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, which team was yours, and how did I offend your sensibility on your team? Right. If you go back and go listen to the podcast and listen to what I said, and which team did I choose?
You didn't choose any team.
Exactly.
But someone is inferring that you are choosing a team because that's just what they want to hear.
Exactly.
And that's how it relates back to the market.
And oftentimes, what happens is we set up expectations too. Sometimes mm-hmm. there are our own expectations, like, oh, the market's got to crash. Why? Well, because it confirms the bias that I brought into the data.
Yes.
Right? I already had an opinion that this would happen, so I need to find the things that support my opinion so that I can be right. Well, what if it's not about being right? What if it's about just trying to be accurate?
David, you're bringing so much logic into this show. Be careful. You're going to...
Somebody's mind's going to blow.
Yeah.
So I have one last thought on the $3.5 trillion, right?
Okay.
And I'm going to totally make you wait until after
the
last
David,
break.
Again.
We're going to do it, right?
Do we really have one more break?
We have one more break.
Okay.
And then I'm going to ask you guys why. Think about it hard, because when we come back, I'm going to challenge something, because then you might find yourself going like, oh, snap. But hey, break first. We'll be right back. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang. Welcome back to the home stretch of the True Wealth Show. If you are just tuning in, grab that podcast at littlejohnfs.com. It'll post tomorrow. We're talking expectations versus reality today. And I have held this one out to our listeners for long enough. You know, Washington, D.C. is a player in the way markets work. Whether we mean to or not, it matters, because they affect the whole system. And there's a bunch of stuff on the docket that's likely to change if the votes turn out the way they could. Okay, a lot of changes to tax policy. And there is a big potential spending package out there for $3.5 trillion that the Democrat Party has brought forth. The Republican Party has brought forth also a big spend, I think north of $1 trillion. So what does this really mean here? And this is, you know, I told you that story to tell you another one. Okay. And the story is about the art of the deal. Now, for many of you, you hear that, and if you think, if this conjures up former President Trump, it's okay, right? He authored a book called The Art of the Deal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not making a commentary on Trump good, Trump bad. Okay, you can make that call for yourself. That's not the point. The point was, one of the tenets of making a deal in that book was, if you want to, or at least I think it was in this book. Golly, I should probably read the book if I want to make this claim.
Yeah, so just roll with it.
I'm going, at this point, it's probably
we're
in the
deep.
Book, right? Yeah. Here, there I am disclosing. I haven't read the book, but I know some of the core principles. If you want to appear reasonable, start as really unreasonable, and then come back into the position that you were hoping for all along. So imagine for a moment that Washington, D.C., doesn't think they can get a $3.5 trillion spending package in the first place.
This would be like if I was like, David, can I have $10,000? You'd be like, no. And then if I hit you with, can I have $3,000? You'd probably still be like, no. But if I said, can you give me $5? You'd be like, fine, whatever.
Exactly.
Like,
it's really easy at
that's
that
what
point.
It
it's
is.
Like, yeah, whatever. Here's $5. But the idea is ask for something outlandish.
Right.
And then when you move your position to what appears to be more reasonable, if that was the initial ask, it might have felt outlandish. But because something else was just completely out to lunch, by comparison, it doesn't look so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So you get people to debate the crazy so that when you rein it in, it seems more
like
reasonable.
An actual deal. Yeah.
And that to me is, I think, what's going on politically is there's this gamesmanship where, look, the majority of us look at that and just get mad. Right. Or, well, if you're on one side of the aisle, you get mad at the other side, you get mad because there's no cooperation. Right.
Mm-hmm.
There's people out there saying, we need this. We need to spend to rebuild our bridges and we need to do these social programs. We need to do all these things. Right. Medicare for all and everybody should have free child care. And, you know, we should be more like these other countries. Right. Now, you can believe that. And I'll question some of that because I think the numbers don't really work the way you think they work. I'm allowed to do that. It's my show. Right. But fine. If you want to believe that, that's fine. Nevertheless, when you think about that giant package and everything in there, you may feel like it's a compromise. But for people that said, heck no, that is ridiculous. And then you come back with a $1 trillion package. People go like, oh, whew, dodged a bullet on that one.
Yeah, but did you really dodge the bullet?
And then I find myself going, whoa. $1 trillion.
Yeah, people. I mean, what's the total U.S. debt right now?
I think it's like $21 trillion. So we're talking about almost 5% of GDP.
Yeah.
Of so I think our GDP is around 20. So it's like 5% of GDP, or our total debt's like 27 or 26 trillion, something clownishly big. I'm like,
people are really getting sold that this is a bargain.
Well, but that's the thing. We have moved the needle so much. I got news for you, people, like you, me, everybody. You don't fathom $1 trillion,
yeah.
Right? That number is monopoly money, okay? It's just like, oh, a million, kabillion, zillion. Like it doesn't matter, right? It's all fictional, but it does matter long-term in the system that if we just print money all the time, that at some point people stop trusting that our money is useful.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have people asking whether or not you should buy Bitcoin.
I was just about to say, you've got all those Bitcoin listeners fired up now, David.
Right? Well, they're not wrong, except for one thing. Bitcoin can be regulated out of existence.
And what is Bitcoin denominated in, David?
Dollars.
Huh, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's this circular logic of, well, the government controls most of the physical architecture. I mean, Bitcoin may be happening on individual servers and, you know, collaborated that way. So the mining may happen in individual mining units, but it's still happening on an infrastructure that's largely managed through governments, and they can make it black market. And now they are talking about, you know, the IRS tracking transactions above $600, all transactions, every vendor, every bank. Like,
that'll change things.
Dude, that's pretty crazy. Like the idea
can you
of
imagine how
is,
much that would cost to actually track that?
Well, they were saying like hiring 100 or 110,000 IRS.
Oh, that's what
IRS
we need.
Agents.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, we can't hire people in the private sector right now, but let's create another 110,000
yeah.
government jobs. And how will we fund them? Well, presumably through checking everybody's transactions for everything. My sense is it's a way to eliminate the underground economy. That's what they're really trying to do. It's like we'll kill off everything except for paying the neighbor kid to mow the lawn in cash.
Yeah.
And everything else is going away. So that's an interesting animal
that
right
is,
there.
That is. That really is. That's almost like a topic for a whole nother radio show.
Well, it's huge. I really do hope that that's not how it goes down, because the underground economy saves a lot of people in this country.
It's true.
There's a lot of people that work on tips and cash, and it saves them. I'm not advocating that that's a good thing per se, but I'm saying if you destroy it, we have so much labor that moved overseas for key components of our economy that the service economy can't absorb everything there.
That would be a huge hit.
It's just an economic misstep or an economic misunderstanding to think if you capture all of these things that it will accrue
somehow
immediate
fix
benefit.
Something,
it
yeah.
will create pain first. So anyway, but that's the story of D.C. all the time, right? It's like decisions are made in a vacuum. We often think, oh, we get the best and brightest and put them in D.C. to make decisions. Mm-hmm. And I go,
best
like,
and the brightest.
I don't know. I mean, I think we get the people that will do the job.
Uh-huh.
And I ask, you know, good people all the time, would you do that job? Heck no.
Right.
I'm not going to put my family in that, you know, the crosshairs of the media and all those, you know, people on social media lurking, looking for gotchas at every turn. That's just miserable.
Glad I'm not that person.
It just takes a unique personality to want that spotlight mm-hmm. and be willing to get pounded. So
yeah.
I don't think that is I don't think I could pull that one off well.
You could.
I wouldn't put
You'd
my family
You'd be good at
it,
but yeah.
Who wants the job?
That's the
it's
thing.
It's tough. If you
that's
want the job,
Who
you probably
it?
Shouldn't have the job, right?
I think that's a good
It's
that's
tough.
A good
well,
note.
Look, we're out of time for today. If there is stuff that you need help with financially, Matt, tell me you have the number.
I'm going to take a stab at it. 541-375-0898.
Yep. Oh, my gosh.
Oh,
he's got it.
And I didn't
All
even
right.
cheat this time.
All right,
no phone
until
out.
Next time, 541-375-0898. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
We'll see you later.
The preceding program was paid for by Littlejohn Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.